Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
National Security Advisor Robert O'Brien returned to work at the White House yesterday following a mild case of the coronavirus, while Trump returned to the golf course after a mild case of work.
Recorded from locations that are not 30 Rockefeller Plaza, please enjoy this podcast edition of Late Night with Seth Meyers. On today's show, Seth chats with Seth Rogen. But first, a closer look.
The president stepped out of his right-wing media bubble to do a disastrous interview with Axios, and it went so badly, he immediately ran back to safe ground on Fox News. For more on this, it's time for a closer look. A lot has happened this week, as you can probably guess from this face, the face of an actual journalist sitting across from the President of the United States. You know something has gone horribly wrong when a journalist interviewing the President looks like that. That's the face you make when your dad gets drunk and decides to tell you about the night you were conceived.
You know, you were a shot in the dark, a Mohegan Sun. The cars weren't going your dad's way, but he hit blackjack in the hotel room.
Now, we all know the president has a bad brain. It's well established. You know when you go to the hotel breakfast buffet right before it closes at 11 and the scrambled eggs are all cold and mushy because they've been out since 6 a.m.? That's his brain, and all the hot sauce in the world can't save it. I mean, like, what do you even say about a president of the United States who looks down at his prepared remarks, sees the name of one of our most famous national parks, one of our most storied, quintessential American treasures, and belches out whatever this is.
We want every American child to have access to pristine outdoor spaces. When young Americans experience the breathtaking beauty of the Grand Canyon, when their eyes widen in amazement as Old Faithful bursts into the sky, when they gaze upon Yosemite's towering sequoias, their love of country grows stronger.
Yikes! The worst part is, you know, one of his aides grabbed him before the speech and said, look, there's a tricky word in here, so just so you know, it's pronounced sequoia, sequoia. And then that guy was backstage saying, well, I'm sorry, I didn't think he'd beef it on Yosemite. Guy loves cartoons. Fits of rage. Yosemite sounds like how Sean Connery would pronounce the category on SNL Celebrity Jeopardy. I'll take Yosemite for 200, Trebek. Or Bane. You know, or maybe that would be how Bane would say it. Sorry about that, Daryl. But yes, America's children will be filled with patriotism when they set their gaze upon the wondrous beauty of Yosemite. Perhaps they'll be just as awed by the majesty of the Hoover Dam or the Statue of Liberty or Yellowstone Park. This is like being at a restaurant with your dad the first time he spots quinoa on a menu.
What the hell is quinoa? Hey, ever tell you about the time I boned your mom in Mohegan Sun?
Seriously, how's he never seen or heard the word Yosemite before? He even took two tries and got it wrong both times.
Yosemite? That can't be right. Is it Yosemite?
You know, I don't believe Trump is some undercover Russian spy who infiltrated America, but if he was, This would definitely be a dead giveaway. I'm not spy. My name is Bob Cowboy. I love American things. Yosemite, the Mouse Land, the Washington's penis. The same event, Trump introduced his Secretary of the Interior, tried to ad-lib an explanation of what he thinks the Secretary of the Interior does. And this is what he came up with.
A man who's done a fantastic job, Secretary of the Interior, David, if you could come up and say a few words. And he really has. He has been, he loves it. He loves the interior.
He loves the interior? Is he in charge of national parks or a luxury car? Loves the interior. All leather, white stitching. You can tell his brain is slowly breaking as he thinks, but interior means inside, and I just named a lot of outside places. Is this a trap? Clearly, Trump has no idea what the Secretary of the Interior does. He's like a boss who sees you eating a turkey sub at work and tells everyone, hey, check out old turkey sub over here. Guy loves turkey. Then later that same day, he was talking about the social media app TikTok, which he's been pretending he has the power to unilaterally ban on his own, and he didn't even seem to know what it is.
TikTok is very successful. It does tremendous business in the United States. People are riveted by it. I mean, I have many friends, when they saw that announcement, they're calling. I think their kids love it. They don't, because they don't get to see their kids anymore. But they are. It's an amazing thing, whatever it may be.
Whatever it may be, well, when you figure out what it is, can you tell me too? Because I also don't understand it, but at least I'm not threatening to ban it. I'll tell you one thing, TikTok is not the reason your friends can't see their kids anymore.
Oh, cool, yeah, jokes about kids who hate their dad. Thanks, Seth!
And look, on some level, a 74-year-old shouldn't know what TikTok is. Last thing I want to do is pick up my phone and see Trump doing the 2C slide, but if you're going to ban someone, you should at least Google it, like I did, to make that 2C slide joke. Didn't Google how to pronounce it, though, so hopefully that was in the ballpark. All you have to do is type in TikTok. You at least know what it's called, right?
So, TikTok.
I saw a great TikTok of someone hiking at Yosemite. I didn't finish the whole thing. It was 40 seconds long. The middle got slow.
This is why Trump rarely steps outside his right-wing media bubble. His brain is pureed cottage cheese, and he can't withstand the slightest scrutiny inside the bubble. The ghouls who profit off him can move his arms around and make him seem alive so they can keep partying at his cool house. But when he steps outside, we end up with Jonathan Swan from Axios looking like a tourist who just watched a Times Square Elmo drop his pants and take a on the sidewalk. I mean, to be honest, forget Times Square. That's the face you'd make if you saw the real Elmo take a dump. But he's a puppet. Where does it even come from? You just knew this interview was going to be insane from the get-go. Even before Trump sat down, when he walked into the room holding a stack of papers, you knew it was going to be bat crazy.
You don't want to put the papers in a binder, Mr. President?
No, I think loose paper projects strength.
Those pronouns were like the Chekhov's gun of the interview. You were just waiting for them to make an appearance, and when they did, it was somehow worse than you were expecting.
I think it's under control. I'll tell you what.
How? 1,000 Americans are dying a day.
They are dying. That's true. And it is what it is. Because we are so much better at testing than any other country in the world, we show more cases.
The figure I look at is death. And death is going up now.
Okay,
and it's 1,000 a day.
If you look at death...
Yeah, it's going up again.
Let's look.
Daily death.
Take a look at some of these charts.
I'd love to.
We're going to look.
Let's look.
Well, right here, the United States is lowest in numerous categories. We're lower than the world.
Lower than the world?
Lower than Europe.
In what? In what?
Take a look. Right here. Here's case death.
Oh, you're doing death as a proportion of cases. I'm talking about death as a proportion of population. That's where the U.S. is really bad.
Well,
much worse than South Korea, Germany, etc.
You can't do that.
Okay, there is so much to unpack here, obviously. But my first thought is, generally speaking, when you're the president reaching for a piece of paper, saying to an interviewer, if you look at death, that's not a great place to be. PowerPoint presentations at the office that start, all right, everyone, thanks for coming in. So if you look at death, rarely, almost never, and with promotions. Second, what is this chart? This is the fakest ass looking chart I've ever seen. It's just four random bars with different colors. Is this the printer test sheet?
As you can see, we're doing great with cyan.
Can't even see what it says on the y-axis. This looks like a prop they'd give a fourth grader playing a businessman in a school play. I'm pretty sure this is what George Costanza handed out when he gave everyone donations to the Human Fund. But the craziest part about this is Trump couldn't even remember his own bull. That's how fried his brain is. He wanted to say our case fatality rate is the lowest in the world, which would be wrong and misleading anyway, but he couldn't even remember that. He just knew someone stuck some papers in his hand with some lines on them that supposedly made the U.S. look good. And when he actually had to explain them, he froze like a fifth grader who just got the word milieu in a spelling bee. Trump was apparently so embarrassed by this rare venture outside the right-wing media bubble that after the disastrous Axios interview aired, he immediately rushed back to the safe confines of Fox News, calling in for a phone interview with his friend Lou Dobbs last night and with the Fox and Friends this morning. Just compare the questions he got from Dobbs to the interview he did with Swan.
Do you expect or do you expect the Democrat Party to align itself with the national interest and the welfare of American citizens?
Well, maybe the point of great success. I think the enthusiasm level is at a number that people haven't seen before. Not in a long time.
Yeah, I think there's an almost 30-point gap between Republican enthusiasm for Donald Trump those Democrats for Joe Biden. It's really a tremendous
gap.
Deficit for Biden to overcome.
Right.
Sir?
It's a record.
Are you going to commit more resources to exploring UFOs and open the documents to the public?
Well, I think you're you're the UFO expert. So I'm going to be totally guided by the great Lou Dobbs.
Wow, that is beyond a softball interview. That's how you interview your new puppy. And who's a good boy? Is it you? It's you, isn't it? You're a good boy. Lou, how come you didn't ask some tougher questions? Like, Mr. President, is it hard to hit 30 under par with your big penis getting in the way of your golf swing? Why are you asking him about UFOs? You think that was maybe a little Bane, too. Mr. President. And why are you asking him about UFOs? Think they tell him anything? He thinks it's pronounced Yosemite. The only way Trump would know anything about UFOs is if he got beamed up into one. For the aliens, it would be a total bust. Tell us about Earthlings.
Well, they love to put themselves into Tic Tacs. Not all humans could do it, but I aced my cognitive test. Knew it was an elephant right away. We're lower than the world. Oh, Persian woman, man, camera, TV.
We got a dud, guys. We'll just, I don't know, jump him in the ocean. I'm not wasting a perfectly good anal probe on this guy. Trump can't step outside his bubble without embarrassing himself, and his supporters are aware of this. They admit it. After that Axios interview aired, Rush Limbaugh expressed shock that Trump would sit down for an interview with an outlet that wasn't friendly.
I don't know why he did it. I mean, Axios is not what you would say, what you call from the friendly side of the aisle.
At this point, friendly side of the aisle just means anyone who won't ask a follow-up question. Even a therapist would be too challenging for Trump.
And why do you think you're afraid of commitment?
I don't know. Let's look at the death.
Think about that word, friendly. You know it's bad when even the president's allies talk about him the way a parent would warn a child to stay away from strangers. They talk about legitimate journalists like they're pulling up outside the White House in a windowless van.
Psst, hey kid, you want to do an interview? Tough one? Follow-up questions?
My friend Sean told me not to talk to strangers.
It's rare that we get a glimpse of the president outside his insulated bubble, but we got that this week, and it went so badly he immediately ran back to safe territory on Fox. You can't deal with a public health crisis if you can't even grasp the reality of the problem. Trump's so unhinged, I wouldn't be surprised if he started telling people coronavirus could be cured by eating a
Tic Tac.
This has been A Closer Look.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
A Our guest tonight is a very funny comedian, actor, and writer you know from films such as Superbad, Pineapple Express, and Knocked Up. His latest movie, An American Pickle, is available tomorrow on HBO Max. Here's my conversation with our friend, Seth Rogen.
Welcome back to the show, Seth. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Seth?
I'm good. I know you're in LA now, but you were in New York right before this all started. Were you at least behaving safely when you were in New York back in February?
I was trying. I was at a giant charity event, so it was hard to behave safely, and it was just, there was like rumblings of it in the air. So I, at moments, would just hand myself over to like normal behavior, and I shook 200,000 people's hands at the event, and Martha Stewart was there, and I don't want to support any conspiracy theories, but she had just gotten back from China, where the virus was at that moment very active, and she left because of the virus, and was sharing this information in the face-to-face conversation, at which moment I was like, Martha Stewart? Back away from me, please. But yeah, it was. But if I was to get it from Martha Stewart, it would have been completely.
Oh yeah, because best, you know, it would be that. Scenario. It would be that artisan vibe.
Exactly.
This movie, which is fantastic, is based on a short story by Simon Rich, who also wrote the screenplay. He was a writer at SNL, and I had forgotten a couple things. One, that he wrote your monologue the first time you hosted SNL, and two, that you were only 23 years old the first time you hosted SNL, which is incredibly young.
Yeah, I was. And I think Simon was actually around the same age, but although he looked maybe 9 years old, I think.
Yeah, he was. He maybe looks 23 now.
Exactly. But yeah, and it was really alarming that my monologue was not even conceived of, and Saturday afternoon, I think, was approaching. And again, as a 23-year-old young man who grew up watching SNL and wanted to make a good impression, I was really, really, really nervous. And then Simon, this kid, this guy who seemed, again, like a child, came up and handed me this thing. Hey, man, I wrote this. And I read it, and it was like word for word, like perfect. I literally didn't change one thing, and I remember thinking, if this guy ever writes a movie about a guy who gets pickled, I'd love to be in it.
I went, you know, after working there a long time, and when I went back and hosted, I had this whole new respect for what we put hosts through, because there was this sense of, oh, the monologue, we can push it off, forgetting that when you actually have to host a show and it's the first time you're going to talk to the audience, you'd really like to have it under control by like Monday, Tuesday, ideally.
You like to have some sense of what the first things you're going to be expected to say are. Yeah. Yes. But I've since it is Lauren who said, we don't do the show because it's ready. We do it because it's Saturday at 11:30, which are very impactful words on me.
Yes. And, so impactful that I think he said it maybe a million times.
Exactly. But I apply it to non-SNL things, which I don't know if it works, but I think it does.
You, your monologue, for those who don't remember, because it was a long time ago now, was the sort of idea behind it was you reading a monologue you had written when you were 13 that you wanted to do if you ever hosted SNL, but you were actually doing stand-up as a 13-year-old. This was not a crazy idea. What was your material like when you were 13?
It was 13-year-old stuff. It was, I would write about my grandparents. That was the first joke I ever wrote. It was my grandparents. I would go watch TGIF at their house every Friday while my family went to synagogue and I didn't want to go. And they would argue about... They were both deaf and they would argue with each other. And those were my first jokes I wrote. It was like my grandparents arguing with each other and not knowing what the other person was arguing about.
This is a movie about our ancestors, grandparents, great-grandparents. The premise of the film is that you play both yourself in modern day and yourself from 100 years ago, your great-grandfather, who was pickled and preserved at a pickle factory. And so basically you're playing two versions of yourself, but one from a century earlier.
Yes. It was weird. It was not a choice I made lightly, because there is not you know, I'd say there's a spotty tradition of actors playing two roles in a film, but I honestly felt like it really helped the narrative. That's what convinced me, honestly, in the end. And this idea of, you know, if we met our grandparents when they were the same age as us, what would they think of us? Would they like us? My grandparents barely tolerated me as my grandparents. Like, my grandfather was a tough man. He was a plumber. He was in the war, you know, and he had no time for my modern, you know, my modern crap. Like, it was not entertaining to him. I remember once I was a kid, I, like, my toenail was too long and I asked him to help me cut it and he ripped my entire toenail off.
I was also, because there's also a great amount of heart in this film as well. It's an incredibly silly concept. There's fantastic jokes. But, you know, there is this idea of, like, can a previous generation be proud of, you know, the next generation, even though they're doing different things and different accomplishments. I read an interview with you today where you were saying that your grandparents were never that impressed with your success, but still would be super psyched to go to a McDonald's.
Yeah, they love, and they would steal napkins. That was my my grandmother stole everything. And that was to her, like, no, her greatest accomplishments were the things, like, we would go to dinner and literally you'd see her being like, this is a nice plate. And then you'd go to her house the next day and she would have the plate because she would put it in her purse. And so they really coveted things like napkins and plates. And so, like, the fact that I had, like, a whole closet full of, like, paper towel rolls was, like, very impressive to my grandparents. But the fact that I was in movies, they would always be like, you think you're a big shot? You think you're a big shot? That was their favorite expression.
We'll be right back with more Seth Rogen.
This film is, in many ways, about Judaism, about things that survive over generations, about the different relationships you can have with your religion. There is a joke that is so funny about basically where the 100-year-old version, the great-grandfather, finds out that Jonas Salk cured polio, and his first question is, was he Jewish?
Was he Jewish? Yeah, which is, that taps into a very Jewish thing, which is Jews are very proud of other Jewish accomplishments. And he's so psyched when he finds out Jonas Salk is Jewish. And nothing evidences this probably phenomena more than the book Great Jews in Sports, which is a book every Jewish person has, which is a small book. But that is how much we want to know what every Jewish accomplishment in history ever was, that we will take the 6 great Jews in sports and make an entire book about them.
You mentioned, was it from the jump? Was it the idea that you would play both characters? Was there a time that you, I mean, because it's not necessarily a situation where that you had to play both characters, but it's such an accomplishment both technically and as an actor, because you had to take months off between doing the second halves of the scenes, right?
Well, no, we did the whole first half as Herschel, and then we went back and did the whole other half as Ben. And it's not something I went into lightly, and I actually tried to get out of it several times. We actually did a table read where Ike Barinholtz read the Herschel role at one point, and he was hilarious. And I remember thinking, like, we don't need me to do both of them. We got Ike. But the other filmmakers really wanted me to play both roles, and eventually I wrapped my head around doing it. But yeah, it was incredibly complicated. But what I did find is I do not like working with other actors, and I do prefer working with myself. actors are tough. And when you remove as many of them from the equation as possible, it makes things a lot easier.
Although I think I would like to provide you the opportunity, because you had a stand-in, and I imagine that was somebody who, you know, there's not going to be a lot of glory in being off camera.
Yes.
But obviously this was an incredibly important role in this film.
Yes, Ian Poke was his name, and he was my stand. He played opposite me in almost every scene, and I remember telling him, like, specifically, like, the better job you do, the less it will seem like you exist. And, like, thriving for a complete evaporation on your part. And that's the bullseye you're trying to hit. And he really did an amazing job, and it was, like, in some ways a very, like, selfless, you know, he was compensated, but in some ways a very selfless thing for him to do was essentially acting an entire movie with the understanding he would be removed from it later. And he would, and he played both roles, whoever I wasn't playing, he would play. And He was great. And he was very like malleable and would get my blocking. And sometimes I would tell him like, just don't talk. Like I'm going to pretend I'm hearing what you're saying as I'm thinking of it, but you just sit there and look at me. And he was like, okay, no problem. And he was a great partner. It was actually a lot of fun and he made my performance much better. Yeah.
I was really taken how quickly you forget it is happening at a separate time. And I imagine so much work went into that. And ultimately, like you were saying, like you have to like do all this work to make it then look invisible for the audience to sort of remember, you know, there's not to give anything away, but there's a moment later in the film where you start looking more alike and yeah. That you remember, oh, this has been the same person. This whole time.
Yeah, no, it was another one of those things where like the better job we did, the less it would seem like we did something. It would be like if the funnier you were, the less funny you seemed. Like, the better, the more our jobs were done correctly, the less we seemed like we were achieving anything special or complicated in any way, shape, or form, which was a weird goal to be chasing. But it was a worthy cause, I thought, if nothing else.
You yet are also finding time for another worthy cause. I've seen photos of some of your ceramic work lately. These are ashtrays.
I make ashtrays. I make vases. I make all sorts of things. This is an ashtray I've made. This is one I have.
The ashtray, and the part that I really want to point out, that is a lighter holder on top, yes?
Well, no, you can put your joint in there, and then you can put your lighter in there.
Oh, look at that.
I have two little separate things. I have a few different designs around.
Now, do you keep those all for yourself? Do they stay in the family? Have you gifted them to anyone?
I've given some away. I'll send you a vase if you want one.
That'd be very nice. Thank you.
You got one coming your way.
Hey, man, it's always such a pleasure to see you. Congrats on the film. It's really great. And I look forward to the next time.
Yeah, maybe one day the world will go back to normal. Yeah.
I would like that.
That would be nice. Have a good one.
All right. Have a good one with that.
Late Night with Seth Meyers airs weeknights on NBC at 12:35, 11:35 Central. Original music on the Late Night podcast is by the HE Band. Don't forget to follow the handle Late Night Seth on social media and tell your friends to subscribe to the Late Night podcast wherever they get their podcasts.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.